This is an ABC podcast.
Good morning. Welcome to AM. I'm Sabra Lane, coming to you from Nipaluna, Hobart. It's 20 years since the United States and its allies, including Australia, launched an invasion of Iraq. The consequences of that conflict reverberated around the world, and today, about 2,500 American troops are still there on an advisory mission. Middle East correspondent Alison Horn reports.
When US missiles were first unleashed on Iraq, Sheikh Mohammed al-Harbi's brother was among those killed. On the anniversary of his death, the injustice is still raw.
The Americans are never held accountable for what they do. Have you ever heard of an Iraqi prosecuting an American because he killed somebody?
The shock and awe bombardment was ordered to topple the long-ruling dictator Saddam Hussein and to destroy weapons of mass destruction that were never found. Australian troops were among the ground offensive that fought against resistance by the Iraqi army. Shoaib Akram al-Dalemi was an Iraqi lieutenant colonel at the time.
We saw things that are unbelievable, and we lived moments that a normal person should not live. When we fought against the Americans, we fought for our land and dignity.
It took less than a month for Saddam Hussein's regime to be overthrown, with the US President George W. Bush promising a new era of freedom and independence for the people of Iraq.
In the Battle of Iraq, the United States and our allies have prevailed.
But soon, Iraq was plunged into years of turmoil that included a sectarian civil war, al-Qaeda insurgency, and an Islamic State offensive. The conflict would eventually claim the lives of tens of thousands of people. Today, Iraq is still struggling. Although now a democratic state, political corruption, soaring unemployment, and poverty make some nostalgic for the Saddam era, like Shoaib Akram al-Dalemi.
The situation is getting from bad to worse. I hope that tomorrow is a better day, but it is not the truth.
For others, like Sheikh Mohammed al-Harbi, the pain of his brother's death is mixed with relief.
Under Saddam's regime, the people were poor. When it comes to salaries, development, lifestyle, now it is much better for sure.
But both men agree the reality of life in Iraq is far from what was promised. This is Alison Horn reporting for AM.
Preparations are being made in New York ahead of the possible indictment of former President Donald Trump. Talks between law enforcement agencies had already been taking place as an investigation into alleged hush money payments nears its conclusion. But there's added urgency to those discussions after Donald Trump announced over the weekend he'd be arrested this week and called on his supporters to protest. North America correspondent Barbara Miller compiled this report.
Fans line up at a boxing match in Oklahoma for a snap with the 45th President of the United States. Donald Trump appeared at the event hours after posting on his social media platform that he was about to be arrested in connection with the investigation into alleged hush money payments to women, including former porn star Stormy Daniels. Today, Donald Trump followed up on his platform, accusing the Manhattan District Attorney in charge of the investigation, Alvin Bragg, of taking his orders from President Biden.
The circus continues.
Chris Christie is the former governor of New Jersey.
I mean, look, he only profits and does well in chaos and turmoil.
Donald Trump is facing possible indictments in a number of investigations, including into January 6 election interference and his handling of classified documents. Chris Christie told ABC's This Week program that in the grand scheme of things, he doesn't think the hush money one is all that significant.
I don't think there's many Americans who don't believe that Donald Trump had an affair with Stormy Daniels and that don't believe that he paid her money at the end of the campaign to keep it quiet. So I don't think that the American people probably see this as a huge crime.
Mike Pence was also a guest on the Sunday talk shows in an interview conducted in Iowa. Donald Trump's move is putting his potential contenders for the 2024 Republican nomination in a tight spot. They have to be seen to be defending him.
Just feels like a politically charged prosecution here.
Yet offering some point of difference.
I believe that people understand that if they give voice to this, if this occurs on Tuesday, that they need to do so peacefully and in a lawful manner, that the violence that occurred on January 6th, the violence that occurred in cities throughout this country in the summer of 2020 was a disgrace.
Pressed on this week on whether he'll announce a run, Mike Pence almost said yes.
Well, I can tell you we're getting closer.
Mike Pence, much like another possible 2024 contender, New Hampshire Governor Chris Sununu, who spoke to CNN's State of the Union program, would much rather not be talking about Donald Trump.
You know, there are other issues that really take precedent in terms of where this country needs to go, what we need to do to get stuff done, how we manage our budgets, how we secure the border. There's much more pressing issues of the day. It's just unfortunate this is taking the headline.
There's no indication an indictment will come on Tuesday. It's not quite clear how Donald Trump picked that particular day, but there are reports it could happen by the end of the month. Donald Trump can't change that outcome, but as the Republican Party and wider America waits on tenterhooks, he's made sure once again that he's steering the narrative. This is Barbara Miller in Washington reporting for AM.
Australia's biggest skin cancer study has been hit by an unpublicised data breach, with the personal details of more than 1,000 people feared to have been compromised. The ABC can reveal that hackers broke into the servers holding highly sensitive data collected by the Queensland-based QIMR Berghofer Medical Research Institute. National technology reporter Danny Tran has more.
When a skin cancer study landed in Paul Woodbridge's letterbox, he felt like it was his duty to take part.
Well, I thought, you know, I'll be a good citizen. I live in Queensland, you know, Australia's the sunburn capital of the world and the melanoma place of the world. I don't have melanoma or anything, but I don't want to get it and I don't want more people to get sick. I just thought I'll participate in it. It's for the public good.
The Q-Skin study is being run by scientists at the QIMR Berghofer Medical Research Institute in Brisbane, who are trying to figure out how skin cancers and melanomas develop. It's Australia's biggest skin cancer study and has involved about 50,000 people over more than a decade.
It asked all different health questions, you know, about my skin and moles and things like that. It also had sections in there about family history, my previous medical history, drug use, alcohol use, smoking.
It also asks participants if they'd been feeling depressed or anxious or whether they'd been through a recent divorce. In 2021, Paul Woodbridge was one of the more than 1,000 people who took part in the survey, which stated that all the data would be treated confidentially. But in November last year, Paul Woodbridge was contacted by QIMR Berghofer, telling him that a private data processing company hired by the Institute to process the survey results had suffered a cyber security breach. It's left the 61-year-old disability pensioner from Brisbane reeling.
It just, you know, just makes you a little bit crazy because it's you can't see the end of it. That's what I'm saying. Like, I don't know what's out there and I don't know how it's going to end. And nobody seems to want to help me.
The ABC has seen a leaked email sent days later from the study's principal investigator to a participant, which said their survey data may have been compromised. QIMR Berghofer has told the ABC that names, addresses and Medicare numbers of 1,128 people may have been compromised, but says that no other information, including genetic data, was held by the processing company. The Institute says it notified participants of the breach in accordance with the recommendation of the Office of the Information Commissioner of Queensland. Professor Jane Andrew, who's a data breach expert at the University of Sydney, says there's no legal requirement to publicly disclose a hack.
Because I do think it means that if you then are about to make a decision as to whether you, in this case, engage with this research institute in the future, you actually understand the risks properly.
Paul Woodbridge is still unclear who might have his data, and he's annoyed that QIMR Berghofer has now tried to recruit him for another study.
I'm probably not the only person of this. I've probably sent emails to everybody else who participated in the Q-Skin surveys and other surveys without telling them what's happening and just say, oh, look, trust us again with your data. She'll be right. And, you know, we won't do anything with the last bit of data. It's all good. That's rubbish.
Data breach victim Paul Woodbridge, ending that report by Danny Tran. Federal Parliament enters its final sitting fortnight before the May budget, with the Albanese government looking for majority support for its key climate bill that it hopes will pass in the next 2 weeks. It's been negotiating changes to what's known as the safeguard mechanism, which aims to cap and reduce emissions from Australia's biggest polluters. Business says it's not perfect, but it should pass. The Greens are still threatening to vote the bill down. Political reporter Tom Lowry has more.
There are plenty of topics that divide the federal parliament, but few seem to do it quite like climate change.
This government is committed to taking action on climate change, and the Greens can either get on board with that or they do not. Simple as that.
I don't see why we would vote for something that the Australian people voted against.
That's Resources Minister Madeleine King and Greens Senator Peter Whish-Wilson. One of the government's priorities over the next 2 weeks will be getting its key climate policy through both houses. It wants to change and strengthen what's known as the safeguard mechanism, which caps the emissions of heavily polluting companies. Caps would be lowered over time to eventually cut emissions by 30% by 2030, and companies could trade emissions and buy offsets to help stay under their limits. Some business groups tentatively support the changes. The Coalition opposes them. And for now, the Greens are opposed too. Here's Senator Whish-Wilson.
Unless it works, unless it actually reduces emissions, I don't think anybody's going to support it.
And his colleague, Greens MP Stephen Bates.
We actually want to see a piece of legislation where pollution actually goes down, and that's not guaranteed in the safeguard mechanism as it stands at the moment.
Negotiations have been underway for weeks, and while both sides say they're happening in good faith, some in the business community are anxious another climate policy might fall over. Andrew McKellar is from the Australian Chamber of Commerce and Industry.
We certainly hope that's not the case. The safeguard mechanism, it's not perfect. It's not without cost, but it is the best option that's on the table. And business certainly believes that it's necessary that we have to take that step, and we have to take it now.
The Greens say a deal is still possible, even though the government won't meet their demand to ban new coal and gas projects. Some in the government are willing to pile pressure on. Here's Resources Minister Madeleine King again.
It really is up to the Greens as to whether they want to support action on climate change. I would have thought, given their record, they might want to reconsider their position this time around. So this is a government we're elected to take action on climate change, and we're committed to doing that.
Andrew McKellar says business is wary of what deal the government might strike.
The government cannot afford to give the game away to the Greens. What we've heard of what they are demanding would be completely unacceptable.
There are other bills the government wants passed urgently, including the Referendum Machinery Bill, which will set up some of the framework for the referendum on an Indigenous voice to Parliament later this year. A second bill, including the proposed question and proposed amendment to the Constitution, will be introduced next week.
Tom Lowry there. A Queensland proposal to further relax the state's drug laws will be examined by a parliamentary committee today. It'll mean that people caught with a small amount of any illicit drug, including heroin and ice, will have three chances before they face criminal charges. But drug treatment groups say if the government really wants to keep users out of court, it's time to decriminalise possession altogether, as Stephanie Smale reports.
For the agencies that help people stop taking drugs, diverting people to treatment instead of court is a solid first step. The CEO of the Queensland Network of Alcohol and Other Drug Agencies, Rebecca Lang, says South Australian police have been doing it since the early 2000s.
And you saw an enormous decrease in the number of people appearing in court on drug possession charges. You saw an enormous number of people diverted into the treatment system. What you didn't see is a huge number of people reappearing in either system. I mean, that's been picked away at over the years, so it's less robust than it once was.
At the moment, Queensland only sends people caught with a small amount of cannabis to drug diversion programs. Under this plan, those caught with a small amount of any illicit drug will get a warning first, then offers of treatment programs on the second and third occasions before being prosecuted. It will put the state into line with Victoria, Tasmania, the ACT and South Australia. But Rebecca Lang thinks decriminalising drug possession makes the most sense.
We think we're helping people, but actually maybe we don't need to help people nearly as much as we kind of initially thought.
If police do get involved, does that
set people back?
Yeah, well, we know that there are particular parts of our population that get more attention from police. You know, the lower socioeconomic communities have much lower rates of illicit drug use than socioeconomically advantaged communities. But those socioeconomically advantaged communities are far less likely to be policed for drug possession.
She claims the international evidence for decriminalisation is clear.
What bothers people a lot of the time is that by reducing the penalties for substance use, that more people will be attracted to substance use. And certainly we've got some great evidence coming out of the United States and Canada where, you know, they've moved even a step beyond decriminalisation with cannabis into the regulated kind of space. And even there, you don't see huge increases in the number of people using.
Queensland Police suggested this expanded drug diversion program, but the changes only apply to adults. Youth Advocacy Centre solicitor Damien Bartholomew says it's not fair that police will still get to choose if a child is charged or diverted to treatment at any stage.
We've already seen that the discretion to divert young people by police is not being exercised in situations where it might otherwise be, and there is no capacity for a court to review that decision.
He argues the Queensland court system should be freed up to focus on more serious crimes.
Where adults are being diverted, young people should receive the same benefits so that the court system isn't unduly allocating resources to matters that can best be dealt with by diversion.
The parliamentary committee hearing the feedback on the changes is due to report back by the middle of next month.
Stephanie Smale reporting. In a scene that's become too familiar to residents in Menindee in far western New South Wales, millions of dead fish are slowly floating down the Darling River. It's the worst mass fish kill in the region, which is about an hour's drive from Broken Hill, and the carcasses are beginning to decompose with the water turning green. Bill Orman prepared this report.
It's been 2 months since floodwaters encroached on Jan Denning's property overlooking the Darling River at Menindee, and she's still cleaning up. Now she's watching millions of dead fish float past, killed because of low oxygen levels that occurred when those same floodwaters receded, dragging dirt and bacteria back into an already stressed river.
Pretty hard to comprehend, really. You know, it's just sort of you're walking around in a dried up mess and then you're smelling this putrid smell. And it's a terrible smell and horrible to see all those dead fish.
Authorities have confirmed the overall scale and size of the mass fish kill eclipses previous events. Barkindji woman Michelle Kelly says the community has been trying to raise the alarm after recent smaller fish kills.
But it didn't seem to get the same amount of attention that it got in the 2018-2019, and it's actually bigger than it was back in those a couple of years ago. And I think there was the level of frustration is because nobody wanted to listen to us.
Most of the dead fish are bony brim with some Murray cod.
It's just that feeling of hopelessness that no one wants to take any responsibility for it. And really all we want is to maintain a healthy river.
The New South Wales Department of Primary Industries says the heatwave in the state's west is also increasing the water temperature, adding to the stress on the fish. Joy Becker is an Associate Professor of Aquatic Animal and Production at the University of Sydney.
We, of course, have to let the New South Wales DPI Fisheries fish investigation process take its place, but everything's pointing towards the extreme heat combined with the excess nutrient load in the water causes a sudden and severe drop in oxygen. And when we have water where there's no oxygen, that can't sustain fish life, or any life, really.
An emergency operations centre is now being set up to coordinate the removal and disposal of the fish.
We need to be looking at how we can improve our river ecosystems at this point in time, and then looking to ways where we can forecast and predict when we have those conditions for very high likelihoods of events. And we can start to think about types of remediation that we can put into place to help prevent future kills of this magnitude.
In the meantime, authorities are reassuring Menindee locals that water quality testing is continuing and there are multiple options to maintain the town's water supply.
Bill Ormond reporting there. That's AM for today. Thanks for your company. I'm Sabra Lane.
Hi, I'm Sam Hawley, host of the ABC News Daily podcast. TikTok is the most used social media app in the world, but nations, including the US, are increasingly worried about it and ordering tighter restrictions be put in place. Today, tech and privacy reporter for Vox News, Sarah Morrison, on the TikTok bans sweeping the world. Look for the ABC News Daily podcast on the ABC Listen app.
You've been listening to an ABC podcast. Discover more great ABC podcasts, live radio, and exclusives on the ABC Listen app.